Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's the week of Thanksgiving 2016. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for joining us. On this pre-turkey recording, recounts, fake news, and some holiday traditions. Joining me on the line from our own mothership of sorts, the WUNC studios in Chapel Hill, is Liz Bayer. Hi, Liz.
Hey, Jeff.
Liz is the station's digital news editor. She came to us almost 7 months ago from Minnesota Public Radio, where she was a reporter. Prior to that, she was a journalist in Florida working at the Miami Herald, among other stops. And Liz, you have this odd habit that I'd like to start with of finding yourself around political recounts. What's the deal?
It is a funny story. I came to realize maybe a couple days ago. I was thinking back at my first job as a Cub reporter at the Miami Herald in 2000, and there was a recount in Florida in 2000. And 8 years later, I took my first job in radio at Minnesota Public Radio, and we had a U.S. Senate recount there that year. And 8 years after that, I started my job here in North Carolina, and it looks like we are going to have a recount here, too. So there's definitely a pattern happening here.
That's pretty bizarre. That's pretty random. We're only 2 weeks into this one, and we'll touch on North Carolina a little bit. The governor, Republican Pat McCrory, as we record this on a Tuesday, did officially file a request for a recount today. What I'm gathering from chatting with longtime journalists from here in North Carolina and other folks from around the country like you who have experience with these sorts of stories, this may be a very prolonged saga. We might be nowhere near having a result in the gubernatorial race here.
I would venture to say that, Jeff. I think we are just in the early stages here. If any of these recounts are any indication, it will likely take months. The Minnesota recount between incumbent Senator Norm Coleman and his challenger Al Franken, that took almost 8 months from start to finish. And it was a very tedious, long process for everybody involved, including a lot of reporters who were following that story for a very long time.
All right. I realize, and I ask this question with, I guess, a grain of salt, or I'll preface it with, election law varies state to state, federal to state, and what happened in Minnesota may not be applicable here. But as you mentioned, 8 months, I'm wondering, and I'm thinking about the governor's race here, the next governor, whether that's Pat McCrory for another term or Roy Cooper, is set to be sworn in on January 7th. So if this one were to continue for 8 months, we would be going into July. What happened during that time period? Did the incumbent go back to Congress and cast votes? I mean, surely Minnesota had two people serving as senators during that time, right?
Yeah, in that time period, during the recount, there was one senator at the time, Amy Klobuchar, and Franken, who eventually won the recount, he didn't take office until July. And so that was more than half a year after the beginning of his term officially had started. So during that time, there was only one senator for the state. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens here in the governor's race and what and how that will play out if we do go into a prolonged recount scenario and try to figure out who will lead the state in that time period.
Liz, do you have other takeaways or memories from those recounts? Are there other things that linger for you in your mind when you think back on them?
I think more than anything, Jeff, it's just a real tedious process with a lot of uncertainty for a really long time. You know, when we think of the Franken Coleman recount, when the initial count was completed by mid-November of 2007, Franken was trailing Coleman by something like 200 votes, and that's the margin that triggered this recount. And after reviewing the ballots that had been challenged during the recount and counting something like 1,000 other wrongly rejected absentee ballots, the state canvassing board in Minnesota officially certified that recount and the results, with Franken holding a lead of only 225 votes. So we're talking about individual ballots at this point. And it just takes a really long time to go through this process if it does go to trial, which is what happened in Minnesota. The trial started in January after Coleman's campaign filed a contest, and it lasted throughout that spring. And by April, it was a 3-judge panel that dismissed Coleman's contest and ruled that Franken had won the election. At this point, after all the counting and after all the going back to some of these ballots, the margin was 312 votes. So even by April, we thought this was going to be over. And at that point, Coleman appealed that decision. And it took another couple months until June for the Minnesota State Supreme Court to, at that point, unanimously reject that. And finally, Coleman conceded at that point. So we're talking a very long process that at the end of the day goes down and boils down to individual ballots. And we have a much larger margin here in North Carolina. But if it does go to that, it could be a long, drawn-out process.
Interesting. Roy Cooper's lead on election night was about 5,000. It has since increased to 6,400. That's, you know, based on official results from the State Board of Elections. His camp is saying at this point that it's closer to 8,500 or 9,000. If it were to exceed 10,000, it's possible that there may not be a recount. But based on all the claims of fraud that we've seen here in North Carolina over the last couple of weeks, it certainly feels like there's going to be a legal challenge. One of the things that, and this is more scuttlebutt than anything, but one of the things that we've wondered about is whether or not this whole scene of chaos, whether it's real or perceived, however you feel about it, how much that has to do with laying the foundation for legislators to come back next year and push forward or try to pass some sort of election bill or voting bill. You know, this happened 3 years ago. North Carolina General Assembly, led by Republicans, passed a bill that mandated photo ID and did away with same-day registration and early voting. That turned into a very controversial piece of legislation that ultimately was struck down by a federal court of appeals this summer. So one of the things, and I'm just, you know, theorizing here on a soapbox, but I have wondered about how this is going to play into election legislation moving forward. I mean, I think it's entirely plausible, if not almost expected, that we will see something in the coming months in the General Assembly. Totally throwing you on the spot, Liz, to that point, what were there any changes in Minnesota election law or practices, or did anything come about because of this Senate recount moving forward that you recall?
You know, that I remember, no. I could just not be remembering, but I don't think so. And I think at the end of it all, at the state level, once Coleman conceded, and we just move forward with our new senator in that state at that point. But I could be wrong, and I may just not be remembering at this moment.
Okay, fair enough. It will be interesting to see what happens, and we'll obviously be, I imagine, chatting about this much more in the weeks and perhaps months to come. I want to transition and unfortunately talk about a topic that I think is stressful to many journalists, not something that we wish was front and center, but it is. And that's fake news. And I think it's certainly getting some more play in recent weeks. Obviously, I think it's been a factor on social media with the election of Donald Trump. And that's not to say he won because of fake news or anything like that, but I do think it was a factor. Certainly, you know, was a driving factor in some of the rhetoric that we've been hearing and perhaps dodging in the last 12, 15, 18 months. The Washington Post ran an illuminating and, I think I would contend, thoroughly depressing story about these two guys who run a fake news site earlier this week. What do you think we should be doing as journalists to deal with this element of fake news?
Well, you're right. Before I answer your question, it's definitely something that has become very dominant in the conversation in the last few weeks. And as journalists, we are thinking about this a lot. And at first, we just have to kind of contend with the fact that the reality that it's become so much easier to spread misinformation and conspiracy theories on the internet. And I read that article that you were mentioning in the Washington Post, and it's quite amazing what some people are doing to get information that has not been vetted, that isn't factually checked or correct, that has really no substance out there. And it's scary, but it's also making us as journalists think of the importance of our work. And I think that while we can't control what other people do, while we can't control what Facebook's algorithm does to populate our news feeds day in and day out as we check Facebook, I think what we have to think of moving forward is the role that we do in putting out, in continuing to put out information that is accurate, that is fair, that is factually correct. There are a lot of things we can't control, but we can control our product and what we share both on traditional radio and with our stories for broadcast, but also on our social media platforms, which is where I spend a lot of my time now, as well as on our website. And that's all really important to be thinking of, and it's definitely part of our conversation every day now here at the station and with our reporters and our editors, and how we can continue to just do the journalism that we've been doing for a long time.
As a digital news editor, which I think, if I'm goofing your title, that's fairly embarrassing for me, but I believe as our digital news editor, I'm wondering, what are your go-to sources? Where do you tend to go on a regular basis, if not daily, you know, several times a week? I'm wondering about what those sources are. And also, what do you do, if anything, if you stumble across a new website or a blog, you know, do you try to verify what it is you're reading, if in any way?
Well, to answer your first question, I think I'm a pretty average news consumer. In the mornings, check the major news websites. I check the local ones here in the Triangle area. I'll check National Public Radio, as well as the Times and the Washington Post. Just to kind of inform myself, I do spend a lot of time during the day within our website and our ecosystem of news here in the Triangle. But I think in terms of spotting fake things that might pop up in a Facebook feed, there are definitely kind of habits that I've started to create, if you will, to try to identify things. And I think, you know, you see pictures with big bold letters on them. That's something that's kind of easy to spot and easy to say, oh, this is probably not something that's trusted. Let's put a red flag on this one. I think stories that, you know, for consumers and readers of news, stories that people might stumble on that include links or quotes or that don't include links or quotes or references. I think that's something to watch out for. I think fake stories usually don't include a lot of attribution, and it's just text on a page that doesn't really show the reader or tell the reader that someone else has been referenced, if you will, in a piece. I think one thing I do is if I see something that I've never seen before online, and that seems questionable, I'll try to go to another website also to see if someone else is reporting about it or verifying it in perhaps a more reputable outlet, if they're saying the same thing or if anyone else is reporting about it in that way. And I think I just try to trust my gut, too. Like, if this just seems not trustworthy, then I'm probably not going to take it as fact right away, at least.
The Oxford Dictionary has proclaimed the word of the year post-truth. Did you see this?
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of post-factual America references, too. It's definitely the phrase of the year.
You think this is like a one-way wall? Do you think there's turning back or there's righting the ship, or are we in big trouble?
I sure hope so, because we're still working in this business of trying to tell truth and facts to people. I'm going to still say yes, there's a way to correct this with good journalism. Absolutely.
One other thing that has come up recently in conversations I've had with journalists at the station, but also other reporters and members of the media who cover state politics and friends I have elsewhere in the country, this notion of an echo chamber, and that depending on, you know, by and large, we're part of an echo chamber, and that these walls are continuing to go up. And with social media, people are more likely to run to their corners. Again, I'm admittedly, I'll share this with everyone, I'm just throwing you a curveball here. Do you think we're part of an echo chamber? And do you think there are any, you know, obvious or clear steps to work on that or to try to, I don't know if improve is the right word or not, but to kind of change that practice or the circles that are evolving?
I think we are to some degree in an echo chamber. I think there, you know, as hard as we try sometimes to get all voices represented in stories, we often are not successful at it. And for various reasons, sometimes it's hard to get people to talk to us. Sometimes people have perceptions of us because we're public radio that may or may not make them inclined to talk with us or share with us or get that side of the story. I think we try really hard to be fair, and I think we try really hard to get all sides of a story. And I think to the extent that we need to, more than ever, continue to try to get those people who don't automatically want to talk to us to talk to us, that's more important now than ever, to try to avoid becoming more of that echo chamber, be in that silo that some perceive us to be in or that we may be in to some degree or not.
Liz Bayer is the guest on the podcast this week. She is the digital news editor here at WUNC. We are chatting about recounts and, you know, the importance of good, fair, impartial, factual journalism. And also we would be remiss if we didn't, you know, touch on Thanksgiving. What was this holiday all about for you growing up?
Oh, I grew up in Miami. And I am the daughter of Colombian and German immigrants. So I grew up with a very big celebration. I mean, dozens of people in the house at once and with a little bit of a Latin twist to it in some regards. There was always some kind of a pork dish in addition to the turkey. We made it our own. And it was all about family and connecting with the people who we may not have seen for a while throughout the year and kind of reconvening and spending some time together. It was wonderful celebrations in very warm climate. Yeah. I've only had cold Thanksgivings for the last 8 years, so this has been different for me.
All right. Favorite dish, favorite dessert, and who were you generally most excited to see come Thanksgiving?
Oh, favorite dish. I love mashed potatoes and gravy. Favorite, what was the second one?
Favorite dessert.
Dessert. Oh, I like a good pecan pie.
Not pecan.
Pie. Pecan. Which one is it?
I don't know. I had a former, quick sidebar, I had a former colleague. He now works with Georgia Public Broadcasting. He was I worked with him at WFDD in Winston-Salem, and he actually did a story for Marketplace on pecan versus pecan or pecan, about just the pronunciation of it, kind of a light story from Marketplace a few months ago.
I'll have to pull that up.
You'll have to do that. So that's favorite dessert. And who were you most excited to see?
Oh, my nieces and nephews.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Definitely the kids.
One thing I generally share with people, and they don't believe me when I put this out, Thanksgiving's for me. So I grew up in the Northeast, and traditionally, there is Thanksgiving Day football, high school Thanksgiving Day football in the Northeast. So when I was a kid, my dad and I used to go back to the town where he grew up because he played high school football, and we would watch the game on Thanksgiving morning, and then we would go elsewhere and meet my mom and my sister. We did Thanksgiving at a place called Lake Chagagagog, Man Chagagog Chabunagungamog.
You're kidding me.
And I don't know if I've actually ever said that on the radio before, because there's really no way to work that into a news story. This lake that's in Webster, Massachusetts. Yes, again, Chagagagog, Man Chagagog, Chabunagungamog. It's one word, I think. And I believe, or at least this is what they told us when we were little, the loose translation is, you fish on your side, I fish on my side, no one fishes in the middle.
That's excellent.
So that's where I spent many of my Thanksgivings growing up.
I'm impressed you can say that.
I can't spell it, which is probably a sign, as much that I'm in radio, that it's very difficult to spell. Do you have a favorite I mean, you've done Miami and Minnesota. Have you done Thanksgivings in other places?
No.
Okay.
No, not that I know.
Would you prefer warmth and sand and salt water nearby, or did you kind of fall for the frigid nature and the dark by 4:15 in the afternoon?
Oh, I fell for the cold.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, it's just getting cold enough here in North Carolina.
Any other Thanksgiving memories or things about this year that you either look forward to or that you despise? I despise short days, 'cause when I get out of work and I, you know, you just don't have the light outside, whether it's go for a run or sit on your back porch or whatever, that drives me a little bit nuts. And I grew up with it, so I'm used to it. But good or bad things from these next few weeks from you?
I actually like the early darkness. And I'm a morning person, so it doesn't bother me as much because I enjoy the light in the morning so much more than walking my dog in the dark at 7 in the morning. So I don't mind it. And I like, you know, the days leading up to winter solstice and acknowledging that then the days will start getting a little brighter every day after that. So this is a good time for me.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, we will leave it there. Liz, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
That will do it. Please feel free to share this episode on Twitter and or Facebook. And remember that you can subscribe to the WUNC Politics Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, and stay up to date with all those latest recount stories and political news at our website, wunc.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Have a safe and happy holiday weekend.